including the biggest of all coaches, in more ways than one, Tony Robbins. Arguably the most successful motivational speaker in history, Tony Robbins is nothing short of a human dynamo. He's a bundle of indefatigable energy capable of nearly inhuman feats. He's 6'7" tall, but spry and nimble. He can walk across hot coals and keep a crowd of thousands captivated during his legendary week-long motivation marathons. All of this he embodies at virtually the same age as Wim Hof himself. They're born 10 months apart. After decades of emotionally demanding work and a calendar perpetually filled with grueling international travel. If you ask Tony, a big part of his capability springs from the fundamentals of the routine I'm going to lay out for you in this chapter. As he says, it's not exactly a gentle way to wake up, but that's beside the point. In fact, it is the point, because this two-part ritual, deliberate, conscious breathing exercises and cold water exposure, goes a long way toward explaining Tony's bottomless resolve, vitality, and energy. It also explains why he's been one of the most successful people in history. He practices overcoming resistance every single day. The breath. There are hundreds of different breathing traditions from all over the world. Some are shrouded in arcane symbolism. Others come with complicated instructions like the world's worst IKEA dresser. Ring finger to the left nostril. Spiral helix breath in lotus posture. Turn your stomach into the shape of a vase. Huh? Wim Hof cuts through that bullshit. His instructions are simple. He just wants you to get the breath in. It doesn't matter which hole it comes through because it's what the breath does for you that matters to him. Here is his method in two steps. Step 1. 30 to 50 power breaths. Inhale through the nose or mouth into the belly with deep, powerful breaths. Exhale, without additional effort, just let the chest fall. Keep a steady pace and make sure to focus on drawing the breath deep into your belly. Do this until you feel a slight lightheadedness and a tingling sensation in your extremities. That is the sign that a shift is happening and your blood is hyperoxygenated. For most people, that effect starts to kick in around 30 breaths, but it can take up to 50, depending on certain factors. Note, it's important not to overbreathe to the point of serious lightheadedness, strong tingles, or involuntary closing of the hands. That will take you beyond the currently desired effect and into the realm of a practice called holotropic or shamanic breathing, which is a topic for a different book. Step 2. The hold. Retention after exhalation. After the 30 to 50 breaths, or once you start to feel the tingling, draw the breath in one more time and fill the lungs to maximum capacity. Then calmly let the air out and hold for as long as you can at the bottom of the breath. You don't need to set a world record. Just hold your breath until you feel that gasp reflex and you really want to breathe again. That is one full breath cycle of what has been known as the Wim Hof method. While it is unique to Wim, it has a couple of ancient forebears from the Eastern world, specifically Tummo breathing, sometimes called inner fire meditation, and the yogic tradition of pranayama, which roughly translates to the deliberate control of breath. The part that is particularly unique to Wim is the holding of the breath with empty lungs. Temporarily depriving yourself of breath releases some of the same hormones that coffee produces, namely adrenaline and norepinephrine. This is what makes Wim's method not just relaxing, like much of the focus of conscious breathing, but energizing. It is why it is such a great way to start the day, and why you shouldn't melt into a puddle of terror when you realize that I'm asking you to hold off on your morning coffee for a few hours. You won't need it. This regimen is its own kind of cold brew. The other reason that the Wim Hof method is energizing is that it reduces the chronic stress that makes you chronically tired. The benefits of pranayama on stress are fairly well documented in the literature. Most relevant for our purposes, A recent study on 90 students, randomized to three different groups, fast pranayama, slow pranayama, and control, showed that specific yogic types of fast and slow conscious breathing reduced perceived stress by an average of close to 25% against baseline measurements. Think about what that means for a second. One of the major tools for coping with bad, chronic stress has literally been right under our nose this whole time. It's been a solved problem for thousands of years. And yet we breathe roughly 24,000 times a day while almost never deliberately taking control of our breath. That sounds like hyperbole, I know, but the way we talk about our breath says otherwise. When we're angry or panicked, we're told to stop and take a breath, as if it doesn't belong to us or we've just been giving it away. When we're exhausted or feel rushed, we need to catch our breath, as if we don't have control of it and it has gotten away from us. Deep dive. Wim Hof and Lamaze? Perhaps the most compelling evidence for the power of breath to overcome massive stress load was given to us right before we were born. During delivery, mothers are asked to do two things, breathe and push. Not haphazardly or randomly, but with deliberate and conscious control. Many mothers-to-be take a class prior to delivery that teaches them how to take control of their breath. You've probably heard of it. It's a method called Lamaze breathing. In the official Lamaze guide, the tips and guidelines are simple and straightforward. Breathing is easily subject to conscious control. Therefore, controlled breathing is easy to learn. Slow, deep breathing is particularly effective. The right way to breathe is whatever feels right. There are no rules related to how many breaths per minute, whether to breathe through the mouth or nose, or whether to make sounds. The key here is that the breathing is conscious, not automatic. Sound familiar? These are the fundamentals of the Wim Hof method, and they are the core of Lamaze breathing. Because conscious breathing doesn't only reduce stress, according to multiple studies, it enhances relaxation and decreases perception of pain. If you have been through labor, you know why that's important. If you haven't, ask your mom what it was like to push a watermelon with shoulders through a hole the size of a coin purse. Then go buy her some flowers. Breath is the rudder of our life. We have the choice to either take over conscious control or let ourselves wander aimlessly. If you are going to own the day, you must own your breath. The cold. The Wim Hof method of breathing, like pranayama and Lamaze, is about taking back control of your entire breathing apparatus and focusing intently on the breath. It is the simplest and most important weapon in your arsenal for reducing chronic stress and other birth-worthy stress loads. But it is not until the method is paired with cold exposure that it becomes truly life-altering, a mechanism both for healing and growth. That is because without the cold, there is no external resistance to tell you when enough is enough. There is no force outside the physical capacity of your lungs to push against to guide your sense of progress. There is no acute stress. This is not a revolutionary concept. We have known for millennia that resistance is the shortest path to growth. As iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another, says the Old Testament, Proverbs 27:17. Put more weight on the bar, you get stronger. Run harder, you get faster. It's a form of good acute stress known as hormesis. At its most basic, hormesis is a biological phenomenon in which low-dose exposure to an environmental agent, called a hormetic stressor, produces a beneficial effect, while a higher dose exposure produces a toxic effect. The layman's explanation for this odd duality is often summarized by the famous Friedrich Nietzsche quote, "What does not kill me makes me stronger." In theory, it can apply to nearly any activity, but for our purposes, we are focused on the good kind of stressors, which are natural and acute, the ones that happen quickly and then pass, which create a hormetic response that triggers the body to repair itself and adapt to handling the same or greater stress in the future, aka grow. Vaccination is a good example of hormesis at work. You expose the body to a weakened version of a virus, the body adapts to the stress, develops antibodies, and becomes immune to full-fledged exposure of that same virus. Mark Sisson, best-selling author and thought leader in ancestral health, writes, "Think of hormesis as your body hedging its bet and going a little above and beyond just to be safe. You don't just compensate for the stressor, you supercompensate. You get stronger, faster, healthier, more resistant to the challenge than you were before." Cold is one of those good acute stressors that makes us hardy and resilient, like a Sherpa or a Viking, or a Viking Sherpa. Dr. Rhonda Patrick, a top investigative researcher into the benefits of various hormetic stressors like the cold, put together a brilliant 22-page document highlighting the many research-based advantages of cold exposure, including benefits for brain health, pain management, longevity, fat loss, athletic performance, immune health, and mood. People who swim in cold water during the winter, for example, had 40% fewer respiratory tract infections. So much for mom's advice. Cold showers have also been suggested as a potential treatment for depression. A lot of this rests on the ability of the cold to modulate inflammation. Inflammation. To give you an idea of the importance of inflammation, having a healthy inflammation response is the key predictor for making it to the age of 100 or older. But all inflammation is not necessarily bad. In fact, we need it. At its most basic, inflammation is just the body's response to injury or threat, i.e. stressors, including tissue damage like you would get from exercise or an injury, environmental stress like heat or cold, and pathogens like bacteria or viruses. If the stressor is acute, short-lived, with ample time to recover, inflammation is a positive part of the response that makes you stronger. Deep dive. Good inflammation versus bad inflammation. When you work out, you break down muscle tissue, and the body creates inflammation to get more cells into the area and repair the tissue, rebuilding it to be more resistant to injury. It can even happen with bone breakage. With proper time to heal, bones will become stronger at the point of fracture. When you get sick, it is not the virus that gives you the symptoms, it is your immune system. Fatigue, mild fever, body aches, congestion, the stuff we colloquially identify as the cold or the flu, are actually manifestations of the inflammatory response. Immune cells called pro-inflammatory cytokines are produced and directed to the injured or threatened areas through capillaries that open to promote blood flow and help fix the problem. That increased flow, along with the newly produced immune cells, is the actual physical inflammation. When the virus subsides, so does the inflammation, or so you hope. When inflammation doesn't go away, it is called chronic inflammation. And that is literally like living in Dante's Inferno. Chronic inflammation starts to damage the body. It makes you tired and creates pain. Inflammatory cells can start attacking healthy cells, creating autoimmune diseases and overall wearing the body's energy resources thin. This leads to many disease states and is generally the root of all sorts of maladies. What turns off the inflammation when it is no longer needed, preventing it from becoming chronic, are stress hormones like norepinephrine and adrenaline. So it just so happens that the Wim Hof method is especially adept at releasing a shitload of these hormones. Cold shock has been shown to reliably release up to 300% more norepinephrine, and the deprivation of oxygen from breath holds reliably produces more adrenaline and norepinephrine. But in chronic stress, with the stress hormones norepinephrine, cortisol, and adrenaline present all the time, the body becomes habituated to their presence. The tolerance that results from chronic exposure is not a phenomenon unique to stress or inflammation. As with alcohol or any drug, excessive exposure leads to increased tolerance. In Chapter 3, we will hear how this happens when the constant presence of sugar in the diet makes the body resistant to the effects of insulin. So instead of shutting down inflammation in the presence of these hormones, the body becomes less responsive. Inflammation is allowed to go relatively unchecked, which is the mechanism that turns it chronic. With an acute stressor like the cold or a breath hold, hormones like norepinephrine and adrenaline spike enough to reduce inflammation. With inflammation low, the body can relax the chronic production of stress hormones, and you have the opportunity to break the cycle. Cold mental steel. While the benefits of inflammation and stress are vital, the thing that really sets cold exposure apart from other forms of hormesis is the mental edge it provides. In the smithy of life, cold exposure is the anvil against which your character is shaped and your resolve is hardened. One might say that deliberate conscious breathing is the hammer that does the shaping, so that you might confront your chronic stress and conquer it more completely. Character and resolve are two traits that rarely get tested in modern society, and they tend to atrophy as a result. Resolve, especially, is at the heart of why we let chronic stress steal our life force and why we struggle from our first waking moments to take ownership of our days. The Powhatan Indians, that's the tribe Pocahontas belonged to, didn't have this problem. They would bathe their babies each day in the cold waters of Chesapeake Bay to toughen them up. It was a habit they started from birth and would continue all their lives, each season, each morning. What about the winter? No worries. When the water was frozen over, they'd break through the ice and jump in. It was a daily baptism by frozen fire. Being an American Indian was not an easy life. Not in the mid-Atlantic, not anywhere. It was a struggle, a fight to survive. So you had to practice your resolve for doing the hard things. That cold plunge bred hardiness. It created courage, defined as moving forward in the face of fear. If you can conquer freezing water, even grow to love it, you can conquer anything. Mental override. Nike's slogan, "Just Do It," is genius. When you are sitting on the precipice of your cold tub or the shower nozzle is taunting you, your mind is going to be spinning a million miles an hour, attempting to find a solution for your fear and guide you to comfort. What do? Just do it. The same applies for starting your workout or talking to that pretty girl or boy in the bar or writing your name down on the karaoke call sheet. Even though you're going to feel like a hero when you tackle any of those feats, your mind computer will still scramble to find excuses and justifications why you shouldn't. But you are not your mind computer, fueled by fear. You are the operator of your mind computer. And you always have the choice to ignore the thought output and do it. It's what Albert Einstein was getting at when he said, "You can't solve a problem on the same level it was created." You can't always outsmart the thought machine with more thoughts. Instead, thank the machine for its efforts, take manual control of what is usually on autopilot, and fucking do it. The more you practice this, the better you get. Bodie Miller is the most decorated downhill skier in American history. He's won multiple world championships and every color of Olympic medal. If I had to sum up the reason for Bodie's success, I would call it mental override. I have seen Bodie win a World Cup downhill race against the best competition in the world on 3 hours of sleep and a mild hangover. How is this possible? Because he refused to indulge the thoughts that would tell the average man that it wasn't possible to win a race under those conditions. I have seen Bodie turn an emotionally catastrophic event into a happy vibe in minutes. I have seen him push himself harder than any human being in training. How is he able to do this? Just like Wim Hof, practice makes the master. As a kid, he would push himself to stay longer in the sauna when every part of him was screaming for relief from the heat. He would force himself to roll shirtless in the snow when he wanted the cozy warmth of his cabin. When a song got stuck in his head, he would wrestle his mind until he found total pin-drop silence. This is what made him a champion on the slopes. It is what will make you the hero of your day. And it starts first thing in the morning. Deep dive. Heat is your friend too. No one hates the hot and the cold equally. Those few who do move to Portland and spend their free time weaving their beards into their chest hair. For the rest of us, there is always one that produces a stronger, aw, hell no, than the other. And it is our responsibility to manage that response so we can benefit from all they have to offer us. When it comes to heat, sitting in a sauna, steam room, sauna suit, or traditional sweat lodge and sweating buckets may not seem like the greatest way to spend the morning, but it might actually save your life. In addition to reducing all-cause mortality, hyperthermic conditioning, as it is called, helps blood flow to skeletal muscles and surrounding tissue, supporting circulation and muscle growth. It can help train your cardiovascular system and lower your resting heart rate. It can even assist with detoxification, since sweat transports minerals, both good and bad, out of the body. There's a catch-22 with that, obviously. Yes, sweat can transport things like lead, cadmium, arsenic, and mercury out of your system, but it's going to take the good stuff with them too. So when it comes to detoxification, make sure you put back all those good minerals after you're done sucking out all the bad ones. In terms of sheer effectiveness, build up to 40 minutes, being mindful to stay hydrated and take as many rounds as you need to reach the 40-minute threshold. You don't need to go full Bodhi out of the gate. This is a cumulative gain, so just do your best and make sure to listen to your body. The prescription. Level 1. The power shower. There are some savages in our midst who hop into the shower every morning, crank the cold knob as far open as it can go, and grit their teeth while they do their scrubbing and shampooing and teeth brushing, until the discomfort of the cold slowly wears off and they can finally breathe normally again. I'm not asking you to do that. In fact, I don't actually think that's the most effective strategy for getting you to the place mentally that you should be as you prepare to start your day in earnest. Instead, what I want you to do is to turn the shower to hot and take your normal shower. Don't dawdle, don't hide from the day under the heavy stream of hot water, but don't sprint either. Take care to wash and care for yourself in a way that leaves you satisfied. Then, once you've completed the actual hygienic part of your shower, and while the water is still hot, begin a cycle of Wim Hof breathing. 30 breaths or until you feel a tingling sensation in your extremities, whichever comes first. At that moment, turn the water as cold as it can go and let it hit every part of your body. Your reaction, likely, will be to gasp for breath. Listen to your body's reaction. Listen to the cold. It's telling you what to do. Breathe more. Continue with the Wim Hof breaths until your body and your breathing have calmed to their pre-cold state. When you no longer need to breathe deeply to withstand the cold, hold your breath at the end of your next exhale, this is called the bottom of your breath, for as long as you can until you feel the reflex to grab more breath. If you feel too lightheaded, feel free to sit down in the shower under the stream. Falling on your ass is not a hormetic stressor. It's an emergency room visit, with a better than 50-50 shot, if the statistics hold true, of being treated by a doctor who will have no idea what you were thinking. A typical power shower takes about 10 minutes all in, and as part of that, you should aim to be in the cold water for a minimum of 3 minutes. If you want to go for a second or third round of breathing in cold, go for it. You can even briefly turn on the hot water to create contrast in between your breath cycles. Listen to the signals from your body, explore, and experiment. But at the bare minimum, Just do your best to have 3 minutes of continuous cold exposure somewhere in the process. To the uninitiated, 3 minutes of cold exposure probably sounds both like an impossibly short amount of time for such profound effects and eternity to endure. But once you've done it, it'll be hard not to become a convert, and 3 minutes will feel like a small price to pay for feeling immortal. And once you've gotten comfortable with the power shower, you can take your practice up a notch to full cold immersion. The power shower. 1. Turn the shower to hot and wash. 2. Do Wim Hof breathing, 30 to 50 breaths, or until you feel tingling and or mild lightheadedness. 3. Turn the shower as cold as it can get. 4. Continue Wim Hof breaths until breathing calms. 5. Hold at the bottom of breath until the gasp reflex kicks in. Optional. Repeat breathing cycle up to twice more at your discretion with cold water running continuously or with periods of warm water between cycles to create contrast. Total cold water exposure equals about 3 minutes. Level 2, the polar plunge, cold immersion with contrast. I would categorize the power shower as a form of cold exposure. Cold immersion, or cold shock, is the next level up from that, for exactly the same reason you'd expect. You are not just exposed, you are immersed, engulfed, covered virtually from head to toe all at once. It is shocking. The best way for most people to do cold immersion is in a tub. If you have an icy river or a plunge pool, more power to you. But the rest of us have to be content being a CO2-emitting, ice-melting force of global warming in our own bathtubs. Unlike the power shower, which likely needs longer exposure to produce benefit, submersion for even 20 seconds in 40-degree water can provide the norepinephrine release we are looking for. But we're still going to shoot for 2 minutes because it's the amount of time often studied for cryotherapy and because it is unlikely you are going to get your bath to 40 degrees. Generally, 4 or 5 bags of ice are enough to drop the water temperature in your home tub to the desired level. Hardcore enthusiasts aiming for the 40-degree mark will want more. Kyle Kingsbury, former UFC veteran and director of human optimization for Onnit, explained that it cost him $40 in ice every time he wanted to plunge. That adds up. One solution is to freeze buckets of water in your freezer and use them to make your baths cold all the time. A great way to enhance the process of cold shock is to include contrast. Contrast comes from heating the body once it is cold and then cooling the body once it is hot. It sounds odd out of context, but anyone who has ever been drunk on a ski trip has done what I'm describing. It's the classic roll in the snow and get back in the hot tub trick. Just like with the power shower, you can do the polar plunge every day that you feel healthy. You don't want to do cold immersion when you're sick or under a simultaneous acute stress load. Contrast is not necessary, but for me it seems to produce the best effect. Listen to your body, not to your mind. Learn to distinguish the voices of resistance and prudence. After all, wrapped up in this concept of hormesis, of exposure to good acute stress, is recognizing the appropriate dose. A hormetic stressor is only as good as the body's ability to fully recover from the resistance it overcomes. If the body can't, then the stressor isn't promoting growth, it's toxic, and it's promoting decay. Thus, prudence dictates that you start with level 1 and stay there for as long as you need before moving your way up the ladder, or down into the tub, as it were. And once there, if 2 minutes feels too long for level 2, set that as a goal and work toward it. Only your body will know. It's up to your brain to listen to it. The polar plunge. Do the Wim Hof cycle of 30 breaths while still on dry land or in shower after completing necessary hygiene. 1. Prepare an ice bath or jump in water as cold as you can find. Set a timer for 2 minutes. Or start playing a song that is about 2 minutes long. 2. Continue Wim Hof breathing until you can breathe calmly and normally. Remember, the cold will make you want to gasp for air. 3. Exhale fully and hold your breath at the bottom. 4. If you have extensive experience or have a buddy with you in case you pass out, submerge completely. 5. Get out of the water at the end of 2 minutes. Optional. Go into a warm shower or sauna to create contrast. If you feel up to it, complete a full additional round of cold shock. Be mindful not to push too hard, as the key to hormesis is not overdoing it. Caveat: shallow water blackout. Make no mistake, it is possible to drown in your ice bath. That's not how your hero's journey is supposed to end. The combination of full cold immersion and the breathing may induce what is called shallow water blackout. Just as when scuba diving, the safest bet is to have a buddy or your partner with you while you plunge. If you go all the way under, put up a hand signal or raise your middle finger while you are underwater. Blacking out is not a sign of weakness. It can happen to anyone. So be prudent with your cold immersion. Pro tip: cryotherapy. If you want to take the cold to the next level, and by next level I mean negative 280 degrees Fahrenheit, then you can check out cryotherapy. Typically costing around $40 per session, cryotherapy works by taking one of the literally coldest substances on Earth, liquid nitrogen, and using it to cool the chamber you are standing in. You rotate around like a rotisserie popsicle, and in 3 minutes your skin temperature has dropped substantially, and you feel that rush of energy as the animal inside you comes alive. I've had the pleasure of introducing cryotherapy to a lot of peak performers. One of the most memorable moments was watching Bodie Miller, who I've witnessed walk barefoot through the snow in New Hampshire, start to shiver. Not just a little, a lot. Like a shake weight with ears. That's when I realized that cryotherapy was a different level of cold. Now do it. Believe me, I am no stranger to what feels like profound amounts of stress. When I'm stressed, I tell myself I don't have the time to take an ice bath or do the breathing. I tell myself that I just need to finish a few more things and the stress will go away. I'm good at bullshitting myself, and you probably are too. It's good to have reference points to keep you on track. Tony Robbins has a boatload more responsibility than me, but he takes 10 minutes every morning to Wim Hof breathe and pencil dive into a sub-50 degree plunge pool in his backyard, or crank the shower to cold if he's on the road, or jump into a snowy river if he's at his winter home. If you don't have 10 minutes for yourself, he has said, you don't have a life. He's right. If I am truly owning my day, owning my life, it doesn't matter what is happening externally. To wait for the external world to change before you alleviate your stress is a fool's errand. You know what is beyond that mountain? More fucking mountains. If you're going to climb, then you better adapt. Chronic stress is less about the environment and more about your response to it. So own it. Put yourself intentionally into the occasional fire and take yourself intentionally out of the chronic stress oven. It's a choice. Your choice. Take that power and never give it away, especially to something as capricious as fate and fortune. I'm not saying adding the power shower or an ice bath or Wim Hof breathing to your routine will be easy. It won't be. Just like in life, you are not rewarded for the comfortable choice. You will have to mentally override the fear of the cold. Override the urges that are driving you toward cozy warmth and shallow breath. This is as essential a skill as any. Just know that as soon as the cold hits your body and your fingers tingle, what you are experiencing is the exhilaration of victory. Not just over the cold itself, but over resistance, over stress. What better way to start the day? As the great swordsman Miyamoto Musashi said, today is victory over yourself of yesterday. Tomorrow is victory over a lesser foe. If you can conquer the acute natural stress of something like freezing water, something that makes you stronger, even grow to love it, you can conquer anything. Three pointers. Chronic stress is literally killing us, and the traditional medical model offers us very little help to deal with it. Counterintuitively, one of the best ways to deal with chronic stress is to seek certain forms of acute stress. Through a process called hormesis, acute stress will help you adapt and become stronger. Cold exposure is one of the best sources of acute stress and can be accessed in showers, cold tubs, and cryotherapy. The cold also offers the opportunity to practice an essential life skill, what I call mental override, the ability to make yourself do something that you don't want to do. The breath, when used in accordance with the Wim Hof method or other forms of intentional deep breathing, is an invaluable tool to modulate and adapt to acute stressors like cold shock, while also helping to melt away chronic stress on its own. Chapter 3. More fat, less sugar, or don't eat. Eat to live, don't live to eat. Benjamin Franklin. Breakfast isn't the most important meal of the day, but it might be your most important choice of the day. Will you continue what you have already begun well, setting the foundation for energy and health, or will you take this train straight off the rails? At breakfast, don't just think about breaking the fast. Think about breaking the habit of fast breakfast. This means fast metabolizing foods like sugar and bread are out. Fats and fiber are in. You want foods that are slow and simple for your first meal. And if you can't find them, if all you have is sugar and refined carbohydrates, then skip breakfast altogether. Getting owned. How many times and from how many people have you heard the phrase, "Breakfast is the most important meal of the day"? I've heard it hundreds of times, and I'm pretty sure we have some Madison Avenue genius to thank for it. Unfortunately for Kellogg's and General Mills, it's just not true. Every meal is important. Yet as a culture, we believe in breakfast at any cost, so it is the one meal where we fill ourselves with the most ridiculous shit possible. The typical American breakfast, for example, is usually some combination of refined carbohydrates and sugar made conveniently available to us in bulk on the run at rock-bottom prices by the great people of the breakfast industrial complex. Walk down the breakfast aisle at the typical supermarket. Pop your head into the shops open for breakfast on your way to work or school. What do you see? Nothing but cardboard and wax paper. Cardboard containers filled with health bars. Colorful cereal niblets, sugary fruit juices, frozen waffles, toaster pastries. Wax paper filled with bagels, croissants, donuts, those amazing creations of human culinary ingenuity. Or, if you're lucky, some white bread or a flour tortilla wrapped around a sad excuse for protein. Those are the options made accessible to the average American. Fast foods filled with sugar and refined carbohydrates. This is not breakfast. This is bullshit. It's a blood sugar bomb. One that, when detonated, throws us entirely out of balance before we've even had the chance to set ourselves upon the day. Blood sugar is supposed to rise slowly after you eat a balanced meal full of fats, complex carbohydrates like fiber, the best kind of carbs, and protein, allowing time for the body to release just the right amount of a hormone called insulin to drop the blood sugar and help store the sugar as fuel. But when refined sugar or other simple carbohydrates push blood sugar up quickly, it is toxic to the cells and the body hurriedly floods the bloodstream with insulin, which craters our blood sugar levels, leaving us tired and irritable in the short term and at risk for a variety of health conditions in the long term. This is not just some pesky personal problem we have to deal with on an individual basis. It can also have serious real-world ramifications. In a 2011 study of parole judges in Israel, researchers discovered that judges were significantly more likely to grant parole in the period immediately after breakfast and lunch, when blood sugar levels were rising, whereas a couple hours after a meal break, when those same levels were crashing, they almost never granted parole. It was like a real-world experiment where the hypothesis being tested was the tagline of that Snickers commercial, "You're not yourself when you're hungry." The irritability and discomfort of the blood sugar drop, combined, of course, with the mental fatigue of the work itself, led judges to be far less compassionate. For better or worse, the scales of justice were balanced only so well as the blood sugar levels of the people holding them. But I'm the last one to blame the judges because I've been there. Before I found my way to the Jedi side of the nutritional force, I treated my digestive system like the Death Star trash compactor. In the morning, I would reach for one of my favorite breakfast foods, cinnamon Pop-Tarts. Pop-Tarts. Sugar filling, injected between two layers of refined starch, basically another form of sugar, and coated with frosting made from whipped, powdered sugar. Where did I think the nutrition was coming from? The bready part? It wasn't even bread. I would have been better off just eating the cardboard box the Pop-Tarts came in. At least that has some fiber. An hour after I popped a tart, the high from the blood sugar spike would reliably give way to the irritability, fogginess, tiredness, tired and wired, and hunger that comes with blood sugar collapse. And when that happens, what do we normally do? We step back into sugar's BDSM dungeon with a ball gag full of carbs and pay to become its bitch for yet another day. It is this inherently imbalanced relationship that has made sugar probably the worst thing to happen to human health in the last 200 years. As consumption of our favorite sweet thing has increased over the decades, public health has deteriorated. Obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and even cancer have been linked to sugar and the associated blood sugar swings. The numbers speak for themselves. 30 million Americans have diabetes. Cardiovascular disease is our leading cause of death. Childhood obesity is at epidemic levels, with one out of every five children clinically obese. Only 16% of women and 32% of men don't ever worry about their weight. The great irony of all these statistics, of course, is that we have more gyms, diet coaches, juice bars, and health food restaurants than any place on the planet. By far. Yet despite constant worry and myriad options, we're getting owned by our diet choices. It's hard to call it our fault, however. The fast sugary foods making us fat and sick are perfectly engineered to trigger biological responses that are incredibly hard to resist. High sugar foods release a massive hit of dopamine. Dopamine is a chemical reward for the brain, and as the pleasure monkeys we are wired to seek it. Whether you want to call it an addiction or not, when you figure out how to release dopamine into your brain, you are going to have a hard time stopping. The same is true for sugar. So let me stand up first. My name is Aubrey Marcus, and I'm a sugar addict. Everyone say, "Hi, Aubrey." Even with everything I know now, living an existence dedicated to cultivating discipline and a balanced ethos, if you put a cinnamon Pop-Tart in front of me, I'd still want to eat the fuck out of it. I'd almost certainly take a few bites. The appeal is just that strong. Combine it with brands like Coca-Cola and McDonald's, implanting themselves as pillars of our culture, along with really bad, I mean really bad, nutrition information, and it feels like we never had a chance. Thus, the first step in your nutrition plan is simple. No sugary stuff for breakfast. Period. Instead, we need to add fats back into our diet in sugar's place. Yep. You heard me. Fats. Fats, 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 fats. Get used to the word because you're going to hear it a lot. Make this simple substitution. Fat for sugar. And you will have the sustained, balanced energy to power you all the way up to lunch. And if you can't find a way to make this happen, then skip breakfast entirely. Breakfast is not mandatory. And in fact, you might just be better off without it altogether. Owning it. Diets, diets everywhere, and not a bite to eat. That's what it feels like when you look online at the landscape of diet plans and the commentary that surrounds them. Everyone, it seems, is promoting something different when it comes to nutrition. Paleo, keto, vegan, Atkins, fruitarian, Mediterranean, and countless others, each zealously claiming to be the right diet and the one true way. Well, let me clue you in on the best-kept secret in the health and nutrition industry. As far as diets go, all are a little bit right and a little bit wrong, because a good diet depends entirely on the condition and purpose of the individual. If you have familial hypercholesterolemia, for example, you are genetically predisposed to need less fat. If you need fuel to survive in a post-apocalyptic vampire world and come across some Skittles, then you need to unleash your inner Buffy the Vampire Slayer and taste that rainbow. So instead of arguing about which diet is superior, what we are going to do is focus on what I call universal nutrition principles, evidence-based guidelines that most people will flourish with. These will be spread throughout the other nutrition chapters, chapter 8 and 12, and together form a definitive dietary foundation for sustained energy, weight management, enhanced performance, and sexual appetite, regardless of where you are in the goal-setting process. The first of these principles involves shelving sugar for the foreseeable future and making friends with fat. And if you can't find the resources to get that done, then skip breakfast entirely and reap the benefits of intermittent fasting. Universal nutrition principle number one. Sugar will fruck you up. In 1822, according to Dr. Stephen Guionet, people consumed on average the amount of sugar currently found in a single can of Coke or Sprite every 5 days. Today, we consume that amount every 7 hours, with young males leading the way, consuming up to 100 pounds of sugar per year. Our diabolical addiction to this sweet stuff has not only been linked to obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and cancer, as I mentioned before, but it has also been shown to degrade the skin and contribute to premature aging. There's no need to sugarcoat it anymore. Extreme sugar consumption is fucking us up. But if sugar is making us fat, wrinkly, sick, and dead, how come we can't stop eating it? One of the main problems is that often we don't realize that we are eating it. Sugar hides in everything. Often it's labeled in confusing ways with innocuous names like evaporated cane juice, brown rice syrup, and fruit juice concentrates. In many places, advertisers promote high sugar foods as healthy. I remember when I lived in Australia watching a commercial for Nestle Milo, a cross between Yoo-hoo and Ovaltine, and seeing this sweet chocolatey treat being sold as a type of sports drink for athletes. It's not too dissimilar from how sugar-laden beverages like Mountain Dew and Gatorade are sold in the United States, by extreme athletes crushing them in the midst of doing something totally awesome. The worst is how we market to kids. Cartoon characters and colorful boxes are like the Pied Pipers leading kids to a lifetime of sugar-induced metabolic disease. But those are the easiest sugar issues to combat, and it's already begun worldwide. With bans on television advertising of sugary junk food targeted to children in countries like the UK, Canada, Mexico, and Norway. The good old US of A? Not so much. We tried to self-regulate advertising to kids starting in 2006, but cartoons and Cocoa Puffs are still as friendly as green eggs and ham. Nothing is simple when it comes to carbs. There are two types of carbohydrates, simple and complex. What we usually call sugar is a simple carbohydrate. What we typically call carbohydrates or starch, in the lexicon of diet books and nutrition programs, are complex carbohydrates. This isn't because starchy carbs have commitment issues. Rather, it refers to their chemical bonds, which take longer to break down in the body. So carbohydrates like potatoes, rice, or quinoa are just a slower form of sugar, with a few more nutrients on board than refined carbohydrates like simple sugar, aka candy cocaine, white bread, or that stuff that holds a Pop-Tart together. and slower is always better, since it gives your body a longer and more accurate window of time to respond to the glucose or glycogen that all sugars eventually metabolize into for the purpose of providing fuel to every living cell, including the brain. A lot of people use sugar's role as cellular fuel as a reason to say that sugar isn't so bad after all. But our bodies are smarter than that. If we don't have sugar in our diet, our body will get all Walter White and produce it. This is why even on an almost pure fat diet like the ketogenic diet, the brain still has ample glucose to survive. But on a pure sugar diet, we'd turn into anxious, confused, irritable, obese, diabetic messes. Remember, when sugar passes from the digestive tract, it enters the bloodstream, and blood sugar rises. Left alone, it becomes toxic. So as a response, the body releases insulin. And the liver converts this sugar into fuel in the form of glycogen. But the liver can convert only so much before the glycogen stores become full. Much as your mobile phone battery can't store more energy than 100% of its capacity. So what does the liver do with the excess sugar? It converts it to fat, of course, which is the body's secondary fuel storage system. Deep dive. Sugar metabolism and insulin resistance. When the blood contains moderate amounts of sugar and the body has ample time between releases of insulin, things work pretty well. However, when there is a constant level of sugar in the blood or consistent spikes of blood sugar, not only does the liver convert sugar to fat, but the body has to release a commensurate level of insulin to keep up. Naturally, if there is a fast increase in blood glucose, there will also be a fast increase in insulin. Often this leads to an overcorrection, as the body is in a hurry to drop blood sugar levels. This rapid increase then causes a swift drop in blood glucose concentrations, resulting in the crash we dread so much, and, when you have had too much often enough, a tolerance to insulin called insulin resistance. When the cells become insulin resistant, they aren't able to shuttle the sugar from the blood into the cells as efficiently, and so you aren't able to remove it from the blood. At a certain point, this becomes type 2 diabetes, and the injection of additional insulin becomes necessary to reduce blood sugar. But let's take a second to expand on that cell phone battery analogy, just to be crystal clear. The sugar power supply keeps flowing into your phone, representing your body, even after the glycogen battery is full. Since the battery can't charge anymore, your phone stores the extra energy as a cushiony layer of fuel supply, fat, like a phone case. The longer you keep the sugar power supply flowing without draining the battery, exercising, the larger and wider the cushion around your phone becomes. Then, before you know it, your phone is on a reality TV show called My 600-Pound Phone, and they have to cut a giant hole in the side of your house to get it out. I don't care how much you want to be famous, that's not the way to do it. To be fair, there is a time and a place for carbohydrates, but it isn't breakfast. We'll talk more about how to intelligently work carbohydrates and even a little bit of sugar into your diet later in the book. But for now, remember the DARE campaign and just say no to the white powder in all its forms. Universal Nutrition Principle Number 2. Fat is your friend. In 1980, when saturated fat was rising through the ranks toward public enemy number 1, only 15% of Americans were obese. Today, that number is 36%. All across the Western world, instead of improving heart disease and obesity, we've doubled, and in some cases, as in the UK, tripled it. How did we get here? I don't have enough fingers to point at all the people, organizations, institutions, and cultural forces responsible. But there was a pivotal moment in the latter third of the 20th century when two influential men espoused radically different ideas about nutrition, and the wrong guy won. One man, Ansel Keys, vehemently believed that dietary fat caused heart disease, a theory that would eventually be known as the diet-heart hypothesis. The other, a scientist named John Yudkin, quietly understood that it was really sugar, pure, white, and deadly, that led to inflammation and obesity. The world chose Mr. Key's diet-heart hypothesis, and now the bloated consequences of that decision have created a public health holocaust. When we decided that dietary fat and its associated cholesterol was bad for your health, we started removing fat from our foods and replacing it with sugar and vegetable oils to make up for the flavor we'd lost in the removal process. That two-pronged dietary decision began the pincer movement that landed us in the clutches of the obesity, diabetes, and cardiovascular epidemics we face today. Placing blame is beside the point at this juncture, however. What is most important is continuing to do good science, work that not surprisingly comes to show just how wrong all those diet heart guys really were. Work like the gigantic landmark meta-analysis in 2010 that, after a review of data from 21 studies that included 347,747 participants, found no evidence that saturated fat increases the risk of heart disease. In case you missed that, let me repeat. No evidence that saturated fat increases heart disease. Or, the research published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2006 that looked at 48,835 women who reduced their total fat intake to 20% of calories and increased consumption of fruits, vegetables, and grains in its place. If saturated fat was the problem, then surely replacing it with fruits, vegetables, and grains was the solution, right? Wrong. After more than 8 years, the replacement of fat had not lessened the risk of heart disease, stroke, or cardiovascular disease. Or the 1998 paper before that from the Journal of Clinical Epidemiology that examined people in 35 countries around the world, looking for a direct link between dietary fats and cardiovascular disease. The conclusion? The positive ecological correlations between national intakes of total fat and saturated fatty acids and cardiovascular mortality were absent or negative. In other words, people in nations with higher fat diets were not dying of heart disease. But we shouldn't look at cardiovascular disease as the only endpoints for the science of fat. What was the quality of life of those eating more fats? William Castelli, the director of another study in Framingham, Massachusetts, that started in 1948 and is currently in its third generation of participants, has an answer. We found that the people who ate the most cholesterol, ate the most saturated fat, ate the most calories, weighed the least, and were the most physically active, emphasis added. This is probably not what you grew up hearing. Nonetheless, these findings have been confirmed by the recent resurgence of the ketogenic diet. A meta-analysis of over 1,200 subjects in multiple clinical trials has shown that the high-fat, very low-carb ketogenic diet helps you lose more weight than a low-fat diet. To put it another way, if you don't eat fat, you're probably fat. This is a hard reality to accept for a lot of people, because at a surface level it makes sense that something called fat in food would create fat in the body. Fat equals fat, right? Wrong. You'll want a lot more fat in your diet than you think, despite what all those diet heart haters have had to say about things like saturated fat and its unfairly villainized companion, cholesterol. Deep dive. The truth about good and bad cholesterol. Cholesterol is the fat-like substance your body uses in its cells and tissues for, among many other things, the production of hormones like testosterone and estrogen, which are essential to maintaining good health and protecting against certain types of cancer and depression. To do that, cholesterol needs help getting transported into the body at the cellular level. It needs a ride, basically. Think of cholesterol as cargo and the cell as the port where it needs to be delivered.